again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Orson Welles is our subject this hour, and a wonderful biography that covers about the first third of Orson's life. So it is titled Young Orson. Patrick McGilligan is the author. The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. It covers very interesting history of Kenosha and his parents and Orson in Kenosha back in 1915. Patrick is the author of a number of other biographies on Alfred Hitchcock, just to name a few: Robert Altman, James Cagney, Jack Nicholson, Clint Eastwood, and many others. And we're going to talk about the genius and see if that's an apt term for Orson Welles during all of his life. People were whispering that into his ear, as Patrick reminds us, almost the day that he was born. His history is fascinating, his creativity and how what a wonderful actor he was, and in all parts of theatrical production, how he could do just about everything, how he emerged on the national stage at a very, very young age, even though he had lost his parents. There is so much to talk about with Patrick. And some of you, I'm sure, because he is from Kenosha, will remember a lot of stories about Orson Welles, and we would love to hear from you during the course of this hour. And we can do so by your calling 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hello, Patrick. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for hosting me.
Before we talk about Orson, let's talk a little bit about his parents, particularly his mother, who was a fascinating person in Kenosha prior to 1915, incredibly accomplished artist and pianist, and really kind of the talk of the town.
And the first elected public official who was female. She was a member of the school board and a leading suffragette locally. And his parents were very, very prominent. His birth is announced on the front page of the Kenosha News. And his father was just as prominent. He ran a local brass factory, and he was an inventor. And like his mother, spoke at public rallies for good causes against children working and other such things of the time. And his father had been rumored as a possible candidate for mayor. That's how prominent he was. His mother was from Springfield, Illinois. She was from Lincoln's town. And so she was more of a passer-through in Kenosha, which is the way people looked at her somewhat skeptically. The father wasn't born there, but his mother was. And they were really, I say in the book, they were the young power couple of their time, which is the time, the 10 years before World War I. And then Orson is born in 1915, and 3 years later, he leaves Kenosha for Chicago with his parents in 1918. So he was, you know, understandably somewhat amused when people asked him later in life, you know, what his relationship was to Kenosha, how he felt about Kenosha, because he had lived there for 3 years when he was a child. And he had a kind of distrustful relationship psychologically with Kenosha, because the seeds of his parents' divorce, or they never got divorced. His mother filed for divorce. Their very bitter breakup was in Kenosha. And yet, many other times, and I think it's a theme of the book, he said proudly he was a Midwesterner and even a badger.
Mm-hmm. A badger for his life.
Yeah.
And he had an older brother who had troubles.
He had a brother who was 10 years older than him and had many of the same qualities, being very bright, interested in magic, in performance, and yet had some mental problems that eventually led the family to institutionalize him. And so that kind of cast a shadow over the family and made Orson, you know, the bright hope of the family to succeed where his brother could not. And his brother's tragedy I follow throughout the book, because this is really a more of a personal story, the way the book is told, than it is the story of Orson's filmmaking or even his,
yes,
his stage triumphs, for that matter. And I go into the family relationships and how they affected him and how they affected the development of certain of his key works, but principally Citizen Kane, because the entire book, hundreds of pages, works its way up to him calling action on the first take of Citizen Kane. And in this background, in this deep background, in the family relationships, and in many of the other relationships, because there are a lot of extra family relationships in the story that are very, very important, they influence and many ways, this film, Citizen Kane, which has come to be regarded as either the first or second greatest film ever made, depending on what poll you want to consult, but certainly one of the greatest films ever made, and certainly a film that most of us are familiar with.
Yes. I was interested in this picture, and I referenced it in the introduction to the show, of Orson Welles at the age of 10 in the Cap Times, saying cartoonist and poet, and he's only 10 years old. What he was able to do by the time he was 20 is truly remarkable. How did he get his picture in the Cap Times at the age of 10?
Well, that was one of the reasons why I did the book. I live in Milwaukee. I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Madison, and I was fascinated by the idea of someone whose genius, I'm going to put quotes around the word genius as he would, was formed, you know, in this crucible in Kenosha, in Chicago, in Highland Park, in Woodstock, Illinois, where he went to prep school, in Grand Detour, Illinois, where he spent summers, in Lake Geneva, where he vacationed and also spent part of a summer, in Madison, where he spent a school year, and in northern Wisconsin. These were largely the places that shaped him, although they're very, very interesting and important people along the way. In Madison, by the time he got to Madison, he was 10 going on 11 in the winter of 26 when the Cap Times caught scent of him and was the first newspaper to do a public profile of him with a photograph. And I actually, since I'm from Madison, was a Cap Times paperboy growing up, so I loved I loved this idea of him appearing for the first time in the Cap Times. He was going to a school nearby, a grade school nearby for the year, while his father refurbished a hotel in Grand Detour that he was hoping to open up the next summer. And he was astounding classmates and teachers by beginning to take over the productions and design them and play major roles. And the previous summer, he had been in a basically a summer camp on the shores of Lake Mendota, where he also wowed the camp commander, who is the person who took him into his home on State Street, or right off of State Street near the University of Wisconsin campus, for the next school year. And he had wowed them by working on the camp newspaper and by taking over the school the camp entertainments, and by doing extemporaneous readings and poetry. And for the final night of the camp, the summer camp, doing his first public presentation of Jekyll and Hyde, which he did throughout his life in many, many incarnations in radio and stage and even in film once. So he arrived in Madison already with this sort of bit of a legend or mystique, even though he's only 10. The Cap Times gets hold of him. They interview him. They photograph him. A studio that had been around Madison for a long time then and was still around when I was a boy photographed him for the newspaper wearing a kind of ascot and looking kind of like a chubby chipmunk. You know, it's a quite striking interview because right away the journalist is telling readers that this is an exceptionally gifted child. And then he lets Orson, in fact, recite extemporaneously, he says, a poem that he had jotted down just a couple nights before to the professor, the former camp commander who he was staying with. And it's a long poem that I have in the book as the first example of his published writing. Actually, in the book, it's the second example of his published writing because one snippet exists still from the camp newspaper. By the way, he's quite a good poet. And the poem, which is at length excerpted in its entirety in the book, actually in some ways also prefigures Citizen Kane. So you have this incredibly precocious kid who's privately all of his parents' friends and extra members of the family and family members are whispering the word genius in his ear. And all reporters who begin to meet him, and he knows a tremendous number of reporters, including he knows everybody in the Chicago press, you know, by the time he's a teenager, they're thinking the same thing. This is a very bright kid. And when they go to lunch at the elite lunchrooms in Chicago, taking a break from their day at the museum or at the symphony or at the newspaper, he's invited to join the table and soak up their knowledge and quite often argue with them and banter with them about whatever they're discussing.
So his parents moved in these kinds of circles, high newspaper circles and artistic circles, and these people would come over the house too?
They both did. His parents were very democratic in terms of the circles that they moved in. His mother had gone through Chicago as a musical student student and trained at the conservatory there and got to know all the important reviewers and critics of the day at that time, which was before the turn of the century, and because she was often performing, but she was also often at society functions, also performing and meeting people. And the father, who lived in Kenosha at the time before he met Beatrice Wells, Orson's mother, he also moved in press circles, but in somewhat different press circles. To some extent, he went to the racetrack, and he knew the columnists, and he knew the cartoonists. And so they all knew the same people mm-hmm. in Chicago, which is probably one of the ways they met. And they knew quite famous journalists of the time, and I discussed these various relationships in the book. I mean, one that is very important is the parents were familiar with Ashton Stevens, who was a quite well-known drama critic, perhaps the leading drama critic in America, but certainly in Chicago at the time. A very erudite, sophisticated man who had been around for a long time, coming out from the West Coast, where he had taught banjo to William Randolph Hearst and liked nothing better than to tell his William Randolph Hearst stories. And now, at this time in his life, in the teens and the 20s, and then in the 30s, was working for Hearst newspapers and still idolized his boss, his old friend, his old banjo student, William Randolph Hearst. And Ashton Stevens became, after both of Orson's parents died by the time he was, I think, 15, was when his father died, and he's about 11 or 12 when his mother dies. 10, I think, excuse me. Ashton Stevens becomes a kind of surrogate, you know, father for him, and certainly a great mentor. And there are scenes in the book of them going to the museum together in New York and discussing, you know, mm-hmm. the paintings they see on the wall. And they went to symphony together and plays together. And Ashton Stevens later on becomes the model for the Joseph Cotton character in Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. And he always said that Ashton Stevens was a great mentor and a great mm-hmm. idol of his. And he admired him as a writer. He admired him as a gentleman. And in many ways, he tried to imitate and emulate him. Mm-hmm.
And Joseph Cotton became a friend. Joseph Cotton had some interesting things to say at the memorial service for Orson Welles, didn't he?
Yeah, Joseph Cotton, by the time Orson gets to New York in about 1935 to stay, he runs into Joseph Cotton on a low-level radio show that all the actors did to make a little bit of money. And as was often the case with Orson, and I think it's underrated when you discuss and think about his career, his personality, often he first overwhelmed people physically. He was a very beautiful physical specimen, and people were struck by him. So was Joseph Cotton, for that matter. But then his personality really won people over, and he and Joseph Cotton fell over laughing in the middle of a radio show, and then couldn't get back on their cues, much to the upset of the director and producer, who banned them from ever appearing in a show together again. But that wasn't good enough. You couldn't ban them. They became best friends. And during that time, particularly, now Orson took a few people from the Midwest out to New York with him, or stayed in touch with them, and brought them into Mercury Theater. But people like Joseph Cotton, during this period of the mid-1930s, became the nucleus of the Mercury Theater on radio, on stage, and then later in Hollywood for Citizen Kane. And that became his kind of ragtag troupe, or let's say professional family, that followed him around for much of his life and career, because you have people like Joseph Cotton and other people who were in the Mercury Theater on radio, stage, or in Hollywood in his first film, Citizen Kane, and then in some of his last, sometimes unfinished films in the late 1970s mm-hmm. and early 1980s. So it was a real bond of friendship and a bond of family, too.
I was so interested in the number of mentors he had and realized how important it is to have somebody on your side. And after his parents died so young, he did have so many gentlemen who were on his side who really looked after him, didn't they?
Yes. His parents, he always said, it's important to say, were mythically wonderful people. They were wonderful in their own talents, and they were wonderful in the way that they encouraged him and supported him, sometimes, you know, greatly to their exasperation, because he was a very demanding kid who wanted to have something interesting that he was doing at any given moment, and you had to support him or get out of the room, that sort of thing, which was not very different than the way he was throughout the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. But They eventually had a doctor attached to the family named Maurice Bernstein, who originally came in to take care of the older brother, and originally to take care of the older brother's physical problems, because he was always falling down and breaking a leg or an arm or something, but eventually to take care of the older brother's mental problems. And then the father's drinking, and then the mother's mysterious death, and then eventually when the father dies, he's there in the will to take over as Orson's guardian. So this is in about 1930. So by in 1930, Orson's about 15 years old. He's just graduating from prep school. Most of the kids who are graduating from prep school, his prep school, which was the Todd School in Woodstock, really only goes up to the equivalent of 10th grade. So most of those kids went on to another prep school, or they went on to a college, or they went on to some business occupation working for their fathers. Orson never went on to any other education, even though he was encouraged by his guardian and by his headmaster, Roger Hill, who was the other great influence and surrogate father of his career. They urged him, you know, to do something constructive with his time. Instead, he took his easel and he went to Ireland, announcing he was going to paint the glories of the countryside. But Dr. Bernstein was really in charge of Orson's money, because his father died very, very wealthy, probably a millionaire on today's terms. Mm-hmm. But he put all the money in trust for Orson until Orson turned 25, which is the same age that Charles Foster Kane gets his fortune in Citizen Kane, incidentally. And by the time Orson got that money, which is just before the first filming of Citizen Kane begins, it had dwindled to just a few $1,000s, a joke amount of money, considering how much he had been rumored to be worth and the columnists had said he was waiting to get. And people who were always skeptical or poking fun at him mocked him mercilessly when it turned out that he was no longer super wealthy. And Orson often suspected towards the end of his life that Dr. Bernstein had made off with a lot of this money in some way, either piled it up or put it into his home or his business. I find no real evidence for that. I could see why Orson would think that, but it was the Depression. The bank was in charge of the money. It was shrinking. Orson did borrow against it whenever he could. But these couple of things, several important things really influence his psychology in interesting ways. First of all, being from the Midwest, and which I'll return to in a moment. But secondly, the death of his mother and his father went, you know, before
so,
he's. That would have crippled most of us. It certainly would have given us a horrible complex, you know, throughout the rest of our lives. He really, fought against this idea that he would die young, and he actually lived to age 70, which was the oldest that any Wells had lived, because he outlived his brother at age 70 by a few months. But he had this shadow cast over him, you know, at a very, very early age. And the third thing, which is very important, is that at age 15, he's in the Chicago newspapers with headlines saying he's a rich boy. But he never, never was a rich boy. He never got that money. And so he has a very interesting psychological relationship to money for the rest of his life. He wants it. He'll do anything to get it. And then he'll spend it, you know, before you have a chance to count it. Mm-hmm. And then it'll all be gone and he'll start all over again. Quite gleefully and quite maniacally. But he was never the rich person that that sometimes he's thought to be. He had moments of affluence and moments of great success, but usually the money always went through his fingers. Mm-hmm. Now, I think some of this has to do with being from the Midwest, because people who went after fame and fortune on Broadway or went after fame and fortune in Hollywood were the same kind of people as they are today. They thought that way, and they could really create a fame and fortune for themselves, either in New York or Hollywood. Being from the Midwest, he had a kind of diffident, or let's say, not as committed attitude towards either of those things. And he, also being from the Midwest, and then finally leaving the Midwest when he went off to seek his reputation and career in the mid-1930s, really made him, in a strange way, an internationalist, someone who was very comfortable leaving New York, leaving Hollywood, kicking around the world for the rest of his life, and then gathering around him wherever he went, ragtag, you know, troops of followers of various talent, but usually quite remarkable talent that often he saw before anyone else, and then people who were devoted to him for X period of time for either this project or that purpose. Mm. And that kind of itinerancy, I think, is really also rooted in the Midwest.
Interesting. His ashes are in Spain, aren't they?
Yes, because he said somewhere that you can choose, you can't choose where you're born, but you can choose where you'd like to be buried. And he, after the summer that he went to Ireland and really first became professional and got important acting.
At 16 this was,
at 16.
Right?
And became an important actor for the Gate Theater in Dublin, but also directed plays and did production design for plays at the same time. After that summer, another summer, he went to North Africa and to Spain, and he had a very, very vivid, short, brief period of time in Sevilla where he tried to be a bullfighter.
Oh, my gosh.
And then he really fell in love with Spain. He fell in love with bullfighting, and he ends up spending a lot of time in his life in Spain. He dies in Hollywood, but yes, he's buried in Spain.
What a life.
But this itinerancy thing about the Midwest, it's linked to one more thing about his upbringing in the Midwest that's important, which is he grew up in a household that idolized the touring actor managers of the period, the great Shakespearean interpreters who brought their ensembles, you know, at great cost to themselves, often to the sticks, as we say, to places like Kenosha, but also to Milwaukee, by the way, where his mother also performed at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And he grew up knowing the names of these people and speaking them with the kind of reverence a later generation of boys would do for baseball players, or, you know, collecting their names the way those boys would collect baseball cards. Mm-hmm. And that family had a tradition of going backstage and meeting everybody they saw and inviting them over and treating them like royalty. And in a way, that's what he became, you know, a traveling actor manager for the rest of his life, you know, around the world doing whatever amused him, whatever interested him, whatever caught his passion.
Mm. Many of you, you may not be totally familiar, and certainly nobody is familiar with at least probably all of his life, but certainly the first third of his life is our guest this hour. But we're going to play a little portion, Mercury Theater we want to talk about, and that's what led to some of his work in Hollywood. We want to play a little bit of War of the Worlds because everybody's fascinated by that story, Patrick, so we'll ask you to tell that, and the genesis of Citizen Kane as well. Some of you may know stories or have heard stories about Orson Welles' time in Wisconsin or in Chicago. We're speaking this hour with Patrick McGilligan. He is the author of Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Orson Welles this hour of the program with the author of the extremely well-documented and so well-written and engaging book, Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. We have a little clip from War of the Worlds. I want to talk about his time with Mercury Theater, in which he really became part of the national stage here. And it's something that people will talk about long after we're both gone, I'm sure, this production and what happened as a result of it. And how it was created. Should we hear a little? Well, no, set it up for us. We'll hear a little bit of it, and then we'll come back and talk more.
Well, the Mercury had evolved into a radio troupe, and they were looking for something to put on Halloween Eve, and they went back to an H.G. Wells story, The War of the Worlds. And Orson had it adapted so that it took place, from a dramatic point of view, contemporaneously as a news, breaking news item. And in fact, throughout the entire broadcast, there are various mentions that this is a radio broadcast and allusions to the fact that it's being theatrically produced for your enjoyment. But a lot of people were listening to other things, or they came into the show late, and it really caused a nationwide panic of people thinking people were coming from outer space, Martians were attacking, people were rushing out of their houses, calling the police, getting into car accidents, and it really, for 24 hours, it froze the world's attention. And it's very important in Orson's career, because up until this point in time, he was known as the wonder kid of Broadway and radio, but people outside of show business, you know, may or may not know who he was. But actually, this put his name on newspapers and editorial columns and even on sports pages around the world to this very day as the person who scared the nation.
And here's just a bit of it.
We now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Ah, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the fires, the gas tanks, and the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill.
If you didn't hear the warnings, that would have been something to hear on the radio. I'm struck by all the elements that you hear in that, Patrick. And he was so known for doing production for things, too. You know, if you could see it, it was the hats and the mustache and the magic. But here you've got all the sounds and the really authentic sound of broadcasters, too. He had a very good sense of news, didn't he?
Yes. And I go into some detail, his rise in radio from really being this lowly actor who would just show up and take any lines, including he'd play little girls and old men and do commercials for vegetables the same way he would do towards the end of his life. As someone who then would command his own ensemble and be able to order the special effects and the music, and really was a master at that. And, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Welles' career, which makes it difficult for a lot of people to get a grasp on his complexity and also his greatness, and, again, this word, his genius, is that he has all these different spheres in which he really was triumphant. And if he had never done anything after War of the Worlds or after that period of time when he did Mercury Theater on the air for radio, he would be in Radio's Broadcasting Hall of Fame. He would be remembered for these wonderful productions. The same was true of his time on Broadway with the Mercury Theater, that if he had never returned to Broadway or done another stage production for the rest of his life, he'd be in Broadway's Hall of Fame for memorable landmark productions that really altered everyone's way of looking at certain ways of doing theater, but also certain very, very important works that he produced in a different way for the first time, and then Hollywood, and then what he does in film there. And then he has this whole political side to him where he comes out back to New York in the 1940s, and he becomes a crusading newspaper columnist. He gives up sacrifices a lot of his career to political causes, to working for Roosevelt. And then he has this whole sort of dilettante side of himself where he's a magician, he's on vaudeville shows, he tours on behalf of a vaudeville troupe during World War II, entertaining the troops, doing really kind of marvelous things. And this is one of the reasons why it's hard to see Orson in his entirety, not Orson as 300 pounds plus in his entirety, but all the various aspects of his career, because he really is a guy who got up in the morning and did 18 things or had 18 things planned for the day, whereas you and I and most normal people try to get through three or four. And of those 18 things, you know, some of them may not eventuate for another 20 or 30 years. He had a long vision of what, you know, how long it might take him to do something. The War of the Worlds really was important because it gave him an opportunity to be known for his ability to do things outside of New York and outside of show business. And it really was one of the very important things that launched him to notice by Hollywood, because Hollywood noticed that.
You know, when you were describing all that he's done, I was thinking, here's a guy who must never have slept, because how can you do all of that in a lifetime?
He didn't sleep. He pretended not to sleep, which is to say he would claim to have stayed up all night, but he would catch naps in the taxi and in the back rows of the theater, and he would sneak off to hotels and go to sleep. But he did work very, very late. I go into this in the book, his work habits, and he liked to work until dawn, drinking lots of coffee and sometimes brandy and eating a lot, too. And then when everybody else was waking up, he was getting a few hours sleep before he started his day. And especially in the period of time that I'm talking about, he was doing, you know, when he was doing War of the Worlds, he was also doing a very important show working on opening up on Broadway. So that you, if you follow what he's doing on a daily basis, it would really, really cripple anyone else physically before it got to crippling you artistically. He was a person who did not sleep. When he got divorced from his first wife in that relationship and all of his various amorous relationships of the period I go into in the book, when he got divorced from his first wife and the reporters say, was he a bad husband? She said, well, he wasn't much of a husband, but he wasn't bad. It's just that he was never there. You know, he was always doing something else.
So when he went to New York, did he have a mentor there? Who helped him? Who showed him the ropes? Who helped him out?
Well, Thornton Wilder, the great playwright, was living in Chicago at a time when Orson was still stuck in Chicago, and they met at a party. I think they were set up to meet. And Thornton Wilder was a great friend to a lot of people and a great a booster of a lot of people's talent, young people. And he knew of Orson through the Dublin Theater clippings, which had been reported in the Chicago newspapers and which he knew about through his family. Thornton Wilder did. They spent a long night talking very excitedly. At this point, Orson had decided that he was a writer. He was writing a book about how to do Shakespeare plays in high school, which, in fact, he did finish with his headmaster, and it's really quite a very good book. I don't even mention, you know, the author side of Orson, but Thornton Wilder encouraged him to be an actor. You know, he said, you have such a great physical instrument here, your voice, the way you look. Thornton Wilder knew everybody in New York. His plays were being done in New York. He gave him invitations to meet people like Alexander Wolcott and Catherine Cornell, who he knew was preparing her first ever national tour in Shakespeare, in a Shakespeare play. So he went there. He had been in New York on previous occasions and really had knocked on doors and felt really frustrated. And Thornton Wilder fired them all up again. And he went back to New York with these invitations, and he got the job on Catherine Cornell's road tour, which is takes him around the country for about a year with exactly the kind of job he loved, which is traveling around, playing different parts with a group of actors and actresses, some of whom he stayed in close touch with, some of whom later joined the Mercury Theater. And it really, that was really his college, because that's really where he learned a lot of things about how to be a professional and how to do things in certain situations. And Thornton Wilder, he never forgot. He always regarded Thornton Wilder as his discoverer, and Thornton Wilder kind of looked at that amusingly because he didn't regard himself as Wells's discoverer, but they stayed good friends throughout their entire lives.
Here's some messages that have come in, Patrick. A listener called and wanted to know how you go about starting your biographies and gathering information about the person he's profiling, and it must be exhausting because you have so much information in this book.
Well, it is exhausting, and I always say more time goes into the research than in the writing, unfortunately, because there's a point at which you have to stop researching and start writing, and then you're already late. But I live in Milwaukee, and part of the appeal for me was Kenosha, curiously, and because it's nearby, and I knew that the secrets to the family and the origins of the family were there. And I always do this with every book, by the way. I start out by going to where the person was born. And I go to the courthouses and the parishes and the libraries and the newspapers and people who might still be around, even if they're removed in time. And I spent a long time at the Kenosha Public Library reading about 18 years of daily microfilm. And I would have stopped if I hadn't found just when I started how remarkable a treasure trove it was. And his parents were so well known, and then the family was so well known that they were on the front page or in the newspaper almost every day. That paper is not electronically indexed, which is one of the reasons why I had to do this. It was not good for my eyes, I assure you. But having been a former newspaper boy and a newspaper man, I know how to read a newspaper as fast as possible. And nonetheless, that's where I started in Kenosha. But there were wonderful, wonderful discoveries in archives, in documents, in courthouses, in museums, in libraries, in Chicago, in Michigan. I did the same thing with the Woodstock microfilm. There was great material in the State Historical Society in Madison. All of these places where he lived, there were clues, and there was evidence that had been left behind that other people who have written books about Wells skipped over or didn't necessarily have the same approach in order to pay attention to it. I'm trained as a journalist, so my approach is to go out there and find documents and records, and as much as possible, eyewitness contemporaneous material.
Mm-hmm. And maybe there was something about the fact that you're a Midwesterner as well, that you walk some of the same streets that he did.
Yes, I felt very close to him starting out. I mean, other books about Orson Welles are skeptical of a lot of things he says about growing up and a lot of his memories of growing up. And I think they're skeptical in part because one book follows on another and they're adopting the attitude of the previous book, and you find this in the very first books about him. And I didn't start out that way. I cross-referenced and cross-checked everything he said about the Midwest and every little detail and every person, supposedly, and every date. And having written about a lot of Hollywood people and a lot of film figures who are quite famous, I can tell you that he's as truthful as any of them, if not more truthful than most of them. And that was a great help to take a look at what he said and then go to see if I could find information or documentation that proved the facts of what he remembered. Often when he was repeating what someone else had said to him, it was false or really embroidered because it was not first person. But when it came from his own experience, it was usually true. And there was a tremendous amount of material lying around everywhere to be picked up, sometimes in surprising places. There's a prep school up the road towards Madison that inherited all the archives of a previous prep school in Lake Geneva and had a lot of medical records about his brother, which shed light on the internal dynamics of the family.
Charlotte sends this email. A few years ago, I was a caregiver for an elderly woman in Kenosha, Laura, who is now deceased, who recalled having gone to the girls' school in Woodstock that was affiliated with Wells Prep School. Laura told me that the boys and the girls attended chapel services together. She would see Orson across the aisle on the boys' side. He was also at the school's dramatic productions, and she described him as a pimply-faced boy standing in the wings, shaking a piece of sheet metal to simulate thunder.
That's a cute story.
Yeah, it is a cute story, isn't it? All right, we haven't even got... you're probably listening to this, but if you want to join our conversation, please do so. I'll give you our phone number. I'm absorbed in Patrick's words about Orson Welles, but please feel free to join us if you'd like. By phone, 800-486-8655. So Mercury Theater, he comes to the attention of Hollywood. RKO offers him this incredible deal, right? Kind of unheard of, to go to Hollywood and...
Yes, with this series of great successes in radio and on stage in the late 1930s, he was getting a series of offers from Hollywood, and he really considered himself a theater person. There's a point at which Peter Bogdanovich is interviewing him in his long book of interviews with Welles, and he's saying, "Didn't you dream of being a film director? You loved movies so much," because he did. He saw movies, and he knew he was very sophisticated about filming. He said, "Oh, Peter, you know, a lot of people love movies and don't dream about being a film director." He was devoted to the theater. And so he kept turning offers down. And along came a man named George Schaefer, who had just taken over RKO because RKO was in bad state financially. And George Schaefer is not the most famous mogul in the history of Hollywood. In fact, he's not famous at all. We don't think of him in the same way as we do Louis B. Mayer or Harry Cohn or Jack Warner, all these names we can rattle off, because he was really in a sales division of a couple different studios rising up. And his real greatness was that he was able to tell you what theater on one side of town in Boston drew what kinds of crowds for what kinds of shows versus what kind of theater on the other side of town. So he was able to take films and really maximize their potential in terms of sales. And in order to revive RKO, he was trying to bring a lot of first-rate older talent, but also new talent to the studio, promising them a lot of autonomy. And he had seen and heard of Orson Welles' New York stage productions. Then he took a look at Orson's unfinished film that he had made for a stage production called Too Much Johnson, which is it was rediscovered last year and shown around the world, and people consider it quite amazing. And he decided that Orson was a good bet. So he came to Orson at exactly around the time that Orson's stage career was collapsing because the Mercury Theater had put on a disastrous production that Orson really was trying to drive to a certain ultimate perfection and never quite worked. His stage production's stage future was bleak. He took part of the summer and he appeared in a vaudeville tour in the Midwest, which he enjoyed enormously. Came back to New York with nothing to do, and RKO kept upping the stakes. And finally they said, we'll make you, you can be writer, director, producer, and star. And you can hire your own people. You can bring them out from New York. And all we have to do is agree with what you're doing. And it was this guy, George Schaefer, who Orson liked a lot better than these real charismatic, you know, self-important moguls who had come to him previously. And he always said that George Schaefer was the unsung hero of Citizen Kane. George Schaefer gave it the title. He gave it the title, really? Citizen Kane, when they were really struggling to come up with the title. And Orson had given him the script, and they were talking about it. And he said, Citizen Kane. And so even the title came from him. But inside Hollywood and inside RKO, there was constant resistance to this contract and this trust and this complete faith in this kid, you know, Orson Welles. And at every difficult moment, George Schaefer said yes. So Orson often said that he was the unsung hero of Kane. I think it's true.
Mm. And was Citizen Kane a long time in production, Patrick?
Not really. Orson's first film was a long time in production because he came there a year before and he was originally going to do Heart of Darkness. Mm. And George Schaefer had the idea that he could sell Orson to art houses and to Europe. World War II intervened, and that sank the chances of Heart of Darkness. Orson briefly switched to something else and worked on another project, and this is covered in some detail in my book. And then around the beginning of 1941, he switches over to thinking about a story done in flashback about an American titan in the newspaper world who also has like one or more fingers in opera. And this really resonated completely with his own background. It was set up so it was one of these Chicago-type financiers or tycoons that he had known about as a kid, but also with enough William Randolph Hearst folded in to make everyone nervous, including William Randolph Hearst. And then he begins to work on this in secrecy, along with the connivance of George Schaefer, because the screen trade press was already skeptical of the great genius with his great contract, having been here for months and not started his first film. And while they all thought he was working on something else, he and Herman Mankiewicz were putting together the script for Citizen Kane. And behind the scenes, he was beginning to organize the cameraman, the production design, and the cast, etc. So it wasn't really long in the time in terms of how long it actually took him to put together Citizen Kane. But in a sense, he had taken his entire life up to that point, mm-hmm. creating Citizen Kane.
And there was some controversy about whether or not he wrote it. Was it John Houseman who said he didn't write any of it, or co-writer? Did he co-write it? Did he mostly write it? What's the story?
Well, he would say he co-wrote it, and he wouldn't say, I mostly wrote it. And I go into it in great detail in the book, including best scenes, favorite scenes, who wrote this scene, who wrote that scene. I also use Houseman quite a bit as a source, but to debunk him, because one of the things that's interesting in Orson's life story is he had Houseman as a great friend and partner in the mid-1930s, and they did these great stage productions together. And then they went into radio together, even though Orson in radio was the senior partner. He knew all about radio and taught it all to Houseman. By the time they came out to Hollywood, Houseman was really almost like an adjunct to the operation. Still a great editor, a great judge of things, but feeling kind of like a fifth wheel. Later on, they have a huge falling out just before Citizen Kane, and then 30, 40 years go by of mostly bitterness and not speaking to each other. Mm. And Houseman writes a series of very, very compelling memoirs in which he gives us close-up portraits of Orson in various ways self-destructing. And I go into these these portraits of Orson become the foundation for a lot of books about Orson self-destructing. I go into Houseman's motives and also his facts in some at some length in my book, showing that again and again it's skewed to make Orson look bad and him look good at the expense of fact, and that they're not factual. And one of the things that Houseman really did to wound Orson was to say that Orson didn't write Citizen Kane, or he had nothing to do with it. I go into this in some at some length in my book, and he's definitely the creator of Citizen Kane and the co-writer. He always gave credit to the writer Herman Mankiewicz as being the co-writer as well. But without him, there wouldn't have been a Citizen Kane.
Yeah, right. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we're welcoming phone calls. We're speaking this hour with the author of Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius and the Path to Citizen Kane. Patrick McGilligan is with us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to some phone calls. Mary in New Berlin. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Mary.
Yes. Hi. Good to talk to you. My husband and I talked to Orson Welles in London, and I'm so happy to hear your guest today. This is a delightful show. We were in Harrod's department store, and of course my husband has to go up to the book department. That's the first place you think of, right?
Sure.
And so he goes up there, we go up there, and the book department is totally deserted, except for this rather heavily set gentleman sitting at the back over there, and we go, oh my gosh, it's Orson Welles sitting on this tiny folding chair, all of them. And so we go up and we're just effusing about, oh, Mr. Welles, we just love your Citizen Kane. We've been showing it to our classes for years, and he rather grumpily says, well, yes, I something about, you know, he isn't getting anything from how well known the film is, number one on the film list, you know, people just so happy about it. And so I wanted to ask your guest if that was true. He often did that, I think. He sold his rights, and then he was always, you know, kind of trying to make the next film with almost no money.
Patrick.
Yeah, he sold his rights to the script, for example, which is why it was republished with Pauline Kael's foreword saying he hadn't helped to write it in the slightest. But he sold it for a pittance because he needed the money. And in those days, directors didn't own their films, so the only way he would have made money on Citizen Kane is if it had made money on its initial release.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a long story about how William Randolph Hearst, you know, took umbrage, and his supporters took umbrage, and in various ways killed the movie before it could get a wide release. But that's a funny story. He was grumpy about Citizen Kane, and he did not like to discuss it. He avoided it, went a long way not to discuss it, and he said he never saw it again after he had put it together. Peter Bogdanovich works very hard to get him to talk about it in his interview book. On the last day of his life, which is the last chapter of my book, he appears on the Merv Griffin show. On that day, they were taping an episode in which he was going to do a magic trick, and he was going to appear with his authorized biographer. And he told Merv that he would talk about anything he wanted to do, anything Merv wanted to talk about. And Merv was an old friend of his who had had him on the show many times doing magic tricks and talking about anything, food often. Merv said anything, and Orson said anything, and Merv said even Citizen Kane, and Orson was in a good mood. He said anything, and on that day he did. He discussed anything, but he did not like to discuss Citizen Kane. He did not like this idea that which followed him around, that he had made a near masterpiece or a masterpiece and then frittered away the rest of his life and career, because that's not the way he saw it. He saw it as having had a great time doing a lot of things that he enjoyed tremendously.
Mm. Thank you so much for the call. We have only a minute left. I'm sorry, everybody, but Henry from Columbus. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I've read a lot about Welles, and maybe this isn't one of the books, I missed it, but we know that Alfred Lunt was from Wisconsin and was a frequent host along with his wife, Lynn Fontaine, in Jenison Depot. Did Welles come across the Lunts during his theater years?
Yes, he followed them on stage. He admired them tremendously, and for a while he dressed and had his hair cut like Alfred Lunt. He made jokes about it.
Thank you. Very great book. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, you'll really like it. Could you please discuss, and I think that he thought this was one of his finest works, you write about it, Voodoo Macbeth, what it was, where it came from, and any lasting effect it had.
Yeah, it is the stage play that brought him to prominence in New York. The Federal Theater Project appointed John Houseman in charge of the Harlem Negro Unit, is what it was called, to give black people in Harlem employment by working in the theater. And for one of the first important productions, he hired Orson Welles, who had never directed anything in New York. The only thing he had ever directed was in summer theater and in Dublin, to direct a black version of Macbeth, which was referred to as the Voodoo Macbeth, set in the Caribbean. And it blew the socks off of everybody in New York. They had never seen such a thing before. It's a wonderful, long story in and of itself. And it really set a precedent for what you could do in the theater, and had a lot of imitators and black Shakespeare productions around the country springing up when that play went on tour and was tremendously successful and influential.
Mm. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us. Such an entertaining book. What a life. And you've looked at it so carefully and in such a engaging fashion. Thank you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Patrick McGilligan, the book is Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. We thank him for writing this. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. Scotty Myers produced the hour. Thanks, Scotty. And Scotty did on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. I got to go get Citizen Kane. I haven't seen it in so many years. I want to see it again. So many years. Off to the library. We'll be with you again next Monday. All Things Political starts off our week Monday at 1 o'clock, and we'll have lots of good shows. So stay with us. Thanks for listening.